This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 19th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On this week's book review, I'm joined down the line by Parul Segal, senior editor at the New York Times Book Review. Up for discussion today, we have a book that explores the nature of the do-gooder in Larissa McFarquhar's Strangers Drowning, Voyages to the Brink of Moral Extremity. We have the tale of Marquis de Lafayette, the Frenchman who became an unlikely hero in the American Revolutionary War, by Sarah Vowell, and we'll end with Letters to Vera, a collection of letters by the rather besotted Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov to his wife. All that and plenty more, all coming up here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Parul. Your first choice for today is Strangers Drowning, Voyages to the Brink of Moral Extremity. It's a book by the writer and journalist Larissa McFarquhar that delves into the lives of people who have dedicated themselves to an extreme ethical commitment. It tells their intimate stories and explores the dilemmas they're faced with and their bravery. Parul, explain a little bit, first of all, about who some of these people are.
Some of the people are a Buddhist monk in Japan who's dedicated his life to saving people from suicide. Another pair of people that she focuses on are a married couple who, over, I think, a couple of decades, adopt and raise 22 children, including many with special needs. She also looks at people who donate their kidneys to total strangers, sort of a son of a very upper-class family in India who goes and joins a leper colony. So people who make these enormous sacrifices that seem very confusing to the rest of us.
Right, and what point is she trying to make, Larissa McFarquhar here? What is she saying about do-gooders like this?
Well, I think she is, in the same way that all of us are, we're not quite sure. When we see, like, for example, I have a friend of mine who recently donated her kidney to a total stranger. And on one side, I feel like this is such a saintly act. On the other side, it feels completely incomprehensible. And so McFarquhar wants to look at what is driving these people and why are we both, in awe and uncomfortable? And what she finds is that these people aren't motivated by desires for saintliness. They're really almost never looking for money or glory. But what they possess is a certain kind of, what she calls it, a moral genius, in that, say if you or I were to see somebody in, a great amount of pain in front of us, we would stop and help them. The people that McFarquhar talks about have the ability to imagine people who they cannot see, who are not in front of them, but they know that people are suffering with the kind of immediacy as if they were watching them suffer, and that's why they go to these incredible extents to sort of save them, help them.
So it's almost like an extension of the imagination then, is it?
Yeah. I mean, of course, the thing is that it's incredibly difficult. Things don't go as planned ever, especially for the sort of couple who she describes. I mentioned raised 22 children, and it's at enormous personal cost. Things go wrong. Some of the children get pregnant. There's a case of molestation and abuse. And so she also wants to look at, despite these odds, despite things not going the way they were supposed to, what keeps people still committed to this path?
And I mean, just sort of on a more fundamental level, I guess, is it right to assert this difference between do-gooders and the rest of society? I mean, do you think it, having read the book, do you think it's true that these people are different, a different species?
I think actually there is something very different about them, and they are as perplexed by the rest of us as we are by them. For them, the fact that more people aren't responding in ways big and small is bizarre to them. I mean, and in the other way that they're different species, a lot of these people are bedeviled by the smallest expenditures for themselves. Like, she talks about one woman who asks her boyfriend to buy her a $4 candy, and she is just tormented by the thought that those $4 could have gone to getting a child a mosquito net or something else. So it is a very different kind of moral calculus, I think, that some of these people live with.
Right, they do. They do sound very different to us, I guess. Yeah. Does McFarquhar's writing make us feel a bit more at ease with the morality of her subjects? I mean, having read it, do you feel more easy with them or more uneasy?
I think you feel, her style is very interesting. McFarquhar, she's been a writer, a staff writer for The New Yorker for many years, and she specialized in profiles, and profiles that are very, very intimate. Sometimes she writes even from the point of view of characters, for the people that she's profiling, like Hilary Mantel. What she does in this book is there's a certain kind of coolness and distance. So I don't know if you feel like you understand these people more intimately, but I think you definitely, as you're reading this book, see spaces for yourself to act and change. And you admire them without looking at them necessarily as these morally superior beings. They just, as you said, are somehow a bit more imaginative, somehow a bit more able or interested in imagining other people's experiences.
And did it make you feel, having read it, that you wanted to be a bit more sort of altruistic with your time and money?
It made me feel incredibly, incredibly guilty and incredibly self-loathing, and also incredibly galvanized, because you do see a range of ways that one can help and sort of, just be in a collective body. You know, you don't have to take in 22 children, but there are a variety of ways that you can do this sort of interesting and important work. And what it does is, I think it removes some of the stigma, actually, that surrounds these people called do-gooders, which is a term she uses deliberately because it is a little awkward and it does seem a little pious. And I think she wants to interrogate why we're uncomfortable with these people. And, you know, she sort of just says, like, look, it's everybody sort of says it's better to be the cynic who does nothing than to be one of these sort of like do-gooder people, and you sort of end up, or at least I did, sort of changing my stance a little bit.
Right, so if you want to feel guilty and galvanized at the same time, that is Strangers Drowning, Voyages to the Brink of Moral Extremity by Larissa McFarquhar, which is out now, published by Penguin. Now, we're going to move on to Lafayette in the somewhat United States, an account of the Revolutionary War hero Marquis de Lafayette by Sarah Vowell. Before we get onto the book itself, can you tell us a little bit about the man himself, Powell?
So he was really improbably a 19-year-old aristocrat who somehow persuaded the king to send him over to participate in the American Revolution and become a major general. And he is now pretty much beloved in America, not so much of a great hero in France. And what Sarah Vowell tries to figure out in this book, that's sort of very warm and chatty and gossipy, like all of her rest, like the rest of her books on American history, is sort of what motivated him, and how he was able to do what he was able to do, and what kinds of continuities remain in American politics that he witnessed at his time.
Why would you tell this story now, in a way? What's so relevant about it to our current society?
I think what Vowell's interest to me is sort of looking at American politics as this sort of endless bickering and endless sort of, you know, dramas big and small, and just sort of to say that this has been in our DNA from the beginning, and it is our strength and weakness. But more than that, I think she's just really fascinated by character. I think she was really, really taken by the fact, like, who is this sort of feckless 19-year-old? How did he manage to get over here? Why? He spoke no English, had no real experience. And I think she was so tickled by that, and by his contradictions, and by what he was able to achieve. And that's the sort of riddle she's interested in solving.
And he ended up having kind of relationships, at least, you know, fleeting ones, with George Washington and people like Thomas Jefferson as well.
That's right. He did. And it's sort of, you know, when he sort of came back to the United States later in life, I think it was like 2/3 of the entire population of the colonies came out to see him. So he was enormously beloved. And, the French were enormously important in the Revolutionary War. But again, I think it is also just his psychology, what he was running from as towards. Like, and Vowell has a very deep interest in humanizing historical figures. So, for example, when it comes to Lafayette, you know, she says he was motivated by a desire for glory. He was deeply idealistic. He believed in sort of ideas of the Enlightenment, but he was also trying to run away from his in-laws. So you get this other layer of human history. And so she makes everybody sort of human scale, and is able to sort of bring in a little bit of this gossipy familiarity in a way that sort of makes it all feel very real and present.
Right, so I guess, yeah, it goes a bit from the sublime to the ridiculous there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Val, you mentioned that she used to be a contributing editor on the podcast This American Life. I guess that suggests that she has a very good grounding in telling people's stories. Apart from the kind of, you said, the sort of chattiness of it as well, mm-hmm. does she take a sort of more unusual angle here?
Well, I think one thing that she always does in her books is she also physically goes as much as possible to different places that she's writing about, and she wants to braid the past with the present. So it really does become a sort of living tapestry when she talks about, you know, places that, you know, the Revolutionary War was fought, or places the Continental Congress met. She's always also weaving in who she meets, where she goes, what she's hearing, and it is very sort of alert to that fact. So she does, as you say, you tell a nice story about what's happening.
Is there a kind of a political message, finally? I mean, I guess this story is about, you mentioned it kind of says that, you know, infighting is all goes throughout American political history. Is there a political message, do you think, behind all this?
I mean, I think that her message is always to sort of keep from idealizing history. I think that's the way, this is my reading. You know, she wants to sort of do a sort of warts and all kind of storytelling, and she wants to keep history from feeling too ossified and too far away, and she wants it to feel relevant again, and she wants to sort of free history from how it's used and twisted. I think that's my takeaway about where she stands politically.
Excellent. Lafayette in the Somewhat United States by Sarah Vowell is out now, published by Riverhead Books. We're going to end the show now with a book called Letters to Vera that documents the Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov's correspondence with his wife from the 1920s right through to the 70s. Parul, let's start with what we learn about their relationship.
Well, I think a lot of, the relationship has been known. I mean, it's such a peculiar and oddly enviable marriage. I can't really decide where I am on this because they were so codependent. You know, Vera for 50 years was her husband's amanuensis slash almost bodyguard. She used to carry a pistol around when they were out and about. You know, she saw to the translation of his books, the publishing. She was fiercely protective of him. And, he in turn, you know, as he says in one of the letters, like, he couldn't write a word without imagining how it would sound in her voice. So they were this one body in this way. And what the letters draw out is 50 years of kind of both creative partnership, a romance that almost doesn't seem to fade till the very end, and just sort of the delight that Nabokov took in the world. And our the book was reviewed for us by Martin Amis, who says one of the beautiful things about him is, you know, we like to think about artists as alienated and isolated. He wasn't. He had this surfeit of delight, and everything he saw he wanted to tell Vera about. Everything from the Greyhound bus to what he ate to his psoriasis, everything gets stuffed in this book and sort of related to her for her enjoyment or, you know, just interest.
I mean, Nabokov is probably best known for Lolita, a novel that deals with a kind of sinister and slightly seedy love obsession. Readers, I guess, may be surprised to meet a man here who's very much besotted with his wife. Did you feel the same way?
I mean, I knew how devoted he was to her. I think what I didn't really... I mean, I don't think anybody's actually seen this side of him, which is quite so... open and delighted by the world and light. I think he, you know, not even just the sort of like sinister aspects of Lolita, but he's always been a writer who's sort of hidden behind how abstruse his work can be, how formally playful. You think about things like Pale Fire, everybody's always playing with a mask. And it's very, you know, wonderful to see him so candid, so unguarded. I think it did. It did. That side of him definitely came as a surprise. And I think also just, you know, it's a really rare chance to look at this marriage. So, I mean, this book, of course, like looks at 50 years. The sort of summit in this book, Vera, of course, you know, didn't necessarily share her husband's optimism and sort of mental rigor. And she had a lot of problems with depression and anxiety. And she went to a sanitarium for 7 weeks. He wrote her every day. And some of these letters are... you know, you can just feel him trying to transfuse some of his own vitality to her. He, you know, makes crosswords for her. He makes games for her. So it's a really, it's a whole other side of him you get to see.
I mean, we call this a correspondence, but actually we should mention that at least structurally, it is a one-sided correspondence because Vera eventually destroyed all the letters she sent him. I mean, do we find out more about her, though? Can we make out what her side of the correspondence would have been?
You know, I think some reviewers have said they've been able to. I wasn't. And I think that's something I really did miss a little bit in the book. And my idea of Vera is very much exactly like the woman who methodically, you know, got rid of it, all of her correspondence. She was careful. She feels a little guarded to me. One of the stories I like about the two of them that feels particularly apt is they met at a masquerade ball in their early 20s, and her mask stayed on all night. And I think for me, this book feels a little bit like that. Like, I get to see an unguarded Nabokov, but I still feel like she's a little bit elusive.
Vladimir Nabokov's Letters to Vera has just been released in paperback by Penguin Classics. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Parul Segal, thanks very much for joining us down the line from New York. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our weekly film review. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.